Hi everyone, I'm Adrienne Adamy.
I'm Sammy Adamy.
And I'm Ollie Patrick.
We're the hosts of the Modern Wellness Podcast. A brand new show where we discuss the latest headlines, trends, facts and fads to decode the world of wellness.
As industry insiders, we'll share our analysis, opinions and unfiltered commentary.
We discuss topics ranging from how to build and launch a business in the wellbeing industry,
the weight loss drug that's been prescribed to millions of people,
the increase of loneliness in young males. How could this impact our health?
And as wellbeing and travel merge, would you even consider booking a hotel that didn't have a gym?
Our opinions are shaped by the work we do as brand advisors and entrepreneurs working across the wellness industry.
Our day-to-day lives include testing new products, delivering wellness workshops and retreats, and designing clinical assessments.
But we live in the real world, so we understand the challenges of managing work, travel, kids, training, and life.
Search Modern Wellness Podcast. Brand new shows every Monday and Wednesday.
I tried everything, but until someone speaks your language and shows you, literally shows you, there is another way to live, you can't believe it. Mm. I didn't believe it. And so I didn't need someone to go there, Laura. I just need to know a different way. And I also need someone to be super strict with me. And I had to go inpatient, because just going for a day patient or going to have an hour's therapy, I would just go home and continue what I was doing. I needed that. And I can't say... I came out. I mean, that was really just the foundation. My life is recovery.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfor. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today, we welcome Laura Hearn, renowned BBC journalist, host of Flip It podcast, and passionate storyteller. We discuss the loneliness immediately following recovery, trauma, divorce, bullying, childhood isolation, her advocacy at the BBC for mental health and wellness, and most importantly, how stories saved her life and continue to help her and others, and an anecdote of the addict in a hole, which I tell terribly. Before we jump in with this week's guest, I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys. Laura, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. This is powerful. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Love listening to your brilliant podcast.
You know, on here we have conversations about our past and adversity, and it's not in a poor me way. It's just to explain our lives to people so that someone can identify with us. I'd love to know where you're from, when you was brought up, and how do you see your upbringing?
Oh, gosh.
Just a short question.
Yeah, just a short question. Of course, it's funny being on the other side for a change. But I was born in West Sussex in a very English, a very English country bumpkin village. My life growing up was quite a blur, actually. I don't remember very much. My parents separated when I was very young, and my mum was in a real survival mode, I guess, of trying to survive and feed her kids. And I remember, in fact, I was having a conversation with my mum at the weekend about the house we lived in, and it was, I swear, it was like doomed. Like the people who lived there before they separated, my parents separated, the people after separated.
And it has such house.
Yeah, it was just such a bad energy and I was so sad there. I used to have reoccurring nightmares. It was the first time I kind of thought at the weekend about how I'd lived my life very much in a retreat mode. I would be in my room on my own. I was very, I am quite a, I call myself a social introvert, but I've always been quite quiet and like my own.
I can identify with that.
Yeah, like I'll always be the first person to leave the party. Well, like I need an exit plan or I like going out and I love people, but I also massively love my own space. But growing up, that I was quite, I felt quite a little bit of a loner. And I guess that.
Was this after the separation?
Yeah, I don't remember that. I was like when I was six. I just don't remember my mum and dad ever being together. And it was a very unhappy time. And my mum, we were saved really by my stepfather, Michael. My mum met him and he kind of swept us up and took him to, you know, let us live with him. And he was really like my father figure. But my dad remarried and there were some difficulties there, but we have a good relationship now. And, you know, I love my dad a lot, but it's taken a long time to, you know, navigate that relationship. And I guess Michael, he was at the time, he was a lot older than my real dad. And when you're going to school and kids, you're just like, oh, God, he was like the fuddy-duddy granddad. And he loved Frank Sinatra. And I was like, oh, I hate Frank Sinatra. And he used to make me put my slippers on in between the kitchen and the lounge. Because he was like, well, there's no point like not putting your slippers on and you're going to the lounge. And he'd like, have you turned the lights off if you're not in the room, Laura? And I was like, oh, my God, this guy is such a nag. And I really wanted to be with my dad. And that was really difficult. And
sounded like a very practical, caring man.
He was beyond, and gosh, yeah. He growing up, but I was, you know, I was going. It was difficult. I was like bullied at school, and I didn't really fit in. And I was like, fit in. It's funny, isn't it? You know,
it's a weird one.
It's a weird one. Like, do you belong? I just.
And what's the in actually mean? Like, what is it?
I'm so glad I didn't fit in. Now, like, I don't ever want to be put in a square box.
It's hard though when you're younger because of peer pressure. Because socially, we are social animals. Supposed to be, and if something's different or odd, it's not celebrated. Maybe that's a cultural thing here, because in America it can be celebrated quite well, but here it's like, you know, I remember we didn't have money for when I went from secondary school to high school. I had like these old flares that my mum had let down, but they weren't let down enough. And I remember some kid saying, what, did your shoes have an argument with your trousers?
Oh, yeah, I've heard that one.
First day in, I was like, I felt really bad.
Well, I think my brother says, you need to put some jam around them and invite them around for tea or something.
Exactly, yeah. They've never met. Yeah. You should introduce them. But it can be harsh. When you said, I identify, there was a moment for me as I started to work on myself that I realised that I've been somewhere else. I hadn't been present. I'd been asleep, not awake, and I couldn't tell you where that place was. But it's like a haze.
Your body's there, but your mind, I feel like I've felt 100 times.
And I really feel that I wasn't awake. And I do believe that, I don't think you have to have massive traumas in life to be like that, but things are traumatic to kids, individuals, that maybe, you know, I wanted to be seen and heard, and I had lots of quiet, profound questions at an early age that no one could answer. So it was better for me to shut down.
Like what?
Well, it's very odd. I used to look at my mum, I used to think, who are we? Who are you? And I used to look at my mum thinking, you know, I hear your voice, but if your voice changes, it's still you. If your eyes change, is it still you? Just
what's kids like real, questions. What's not?
Yeah, like what's infinitum? I heard the word God, I'm like, what's that? No one can explain it. Is it a feeling? Is it a person?
That's beautiful. It's a curiosity. I love 100%. That.
My kids are like that now. And I sit down and we get books out and we read them and I try to explain as much as I can. And like, great, thanks, Dad. And they get on with playing. But I think when you're not answered as a kid, there's a buildup of energy. I don't know whether that's what you felt.
Yeah, well, I definitely didn't feel seen and heard. I used to hide in my room. There were a lot of arguments at home with my sister, who was, she was very different. She's would be very outspoken. I suppose she expressed her pain through vocal, whereas I would go into my room and just hide and quiet. And I started, I think then it was then I started to, probably then I started to, I was quite chubby. I felt I was chubby. And I think that's where I started to notice my body and be bullied about that. And I suppose I went through like college and school just feeling really uncomfortable in my own skin and hating on myself and not feeling like I was the popular one at school, never asked out. And I really struggled. The only place I ever found any kind of peace was with in the countryside with dogs or horses. Mm. And I kind of feel a bit, sometimes I feel, I don't often talk about the horses because it can kind of come across as like, oh, posh girl. And I actually didn't go to private school. This is me doing my disclaimer. Didn't go to private school. Didn't have anyone. I begged, borrowed, and stole it. It was only that I was introduced to Pony up the yard. And I was like, God, I'd like get up at 5 a.m. to cycle and see him just to like, but it was just that they've always been so magical to me. So it was the only place that I could escape really. And they've continued to do that for me, but.
Horses are amazing.
Yeah.
We had someone around where we lived who had horses, but I was too scared to ride them when I was younger. But I used to walk around and just look at them. I love animals. I love their nose.
Yeah.
I did equine therapy in America and Arizona.
Oh, did you? I've done
that. And it was mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing for the horse I chose. And they when they asked me, why did you choose, like, chose this strong woman, this matriarch, and they're like, why don't you choose him? And I was like, that's a really good question for me. So I chose this really big guy horse and I wanted him to walk with me and he wouldn't walk with me. And I was like,
why didn't walk with me?
But for me, it sounds, probably doesn't sound like anything for anyone else, but the relationship between me and like a father figure or an older masculine figure, it just came to me what I've been doing all my life and how I recognize
your
it.
Your dad and...
Yeah, and then when I just gave up, like I felt like I just gave up, he came and walked over and put his shoulder on me. I literally just burst out crying really deeply as well. And I was like, wow, you know, this animalistic thing with animals is incredible.
Oh, yeah, horses have been my greatest healer for sure. They're remarkable and they've done... Yeah, I've worked with them in equine therapy and all sorts of... scenarios, but they're definitely my therapy.
Yeah, it's amazing though, isn't it? Nature, something about nature and animals that can be really healing.
But it keeps you in the present moment and they don't judge and nothing is in your control. It makes you realize that really, there is.
It's funny talking to people that that don't know about being present and being awake, because I was like that for years. But it's a weird shift to see things and hear things clearly. And it's so rewarding, because for years I chased cars and ladies and all the things I was indoctrinated in. I thought about, I saw on TV and films how what was supposed to be happiness, and I really chased it to get it. And
it's all fleeting. It's a dopamine effect, because it can't continue.
Nothing's in the heart. Nothing's in the body. It's all in the mind, and it's almost like this Rolodex and register of like, got this, got that, got this, and it's so unfulfilling. And I'm glad I got there, because...
Well, not everyone does, like...
No.
I think you have to break, and then several times. Something
has to go.
Yeah.
So you went to college. Did you go to college to study journalism? And why did you choose that?
I would say that there's been several catalysts, but I guess the biggest catalyst was when I was 18 and... Michael, my stepfather, he was killed suddenly in a car crash. And it changed the course of my life and everyone's around me. That night was pretty brutal. And I had so much guilt around his death, and that I hadn't told him that I loved him. And all the things that, you know, the Frank Sinatra, the slippers, the lights, how I, you know, he used to have a brandy or a whiskey every night when he got in from work, and how I would love to just have that as, you know, smoke a cigar with him, because that's what he did. And all the things that I moaned about him, suddenly was like, they're all the things I want. And I felt so much guilt that I hadn't told him how much I loved him and how grateful I am that he had saved my family, really. I just turned that inwards, that grief. I don't know, I went off to Australia just on a gap year and left my mom. And it was over there that I started being really weird around food. And slowly but surely, that's when my eating disorder began. And I guess it was a way of punishing myself, of repenting to him in a way that if I could hurt myself enough, he'd know how much I loved him. And it was a really messed up thought process, but
a lot of people have this thought process, though. I think it's really important to talk about, because it's all about hiding pain, isn't it? I remember first time I cut myself with a knife was the same thing. It was like a feeling of relief, or like at least the universe will know I'm paying a debt back somehow. Yeah. But it's all internal. It's all in your own big world inside that no one knows about. And I think it's great to explain it to people, because there's a lot of people probably suffering from stuff like that can't express or don't know where to go about it.
Obviously, my eating disorder has been a massive part of my life, like 20 decades. Yeah. But really, whenever I talk about it, it could have been anything. For it could have been drugs, it could have been sex, alcohol. You know, I've had tendencies, OCD, or like all sorts. All it was an inability to process my emotions and to live in the world. And when I was diagnosed, I mean, this was before Facebook, like showing my age. But, you know, when I was 18, like no one even knew what it was. My mom was like, what's going on? I was like getting so angry. I'd throw food over the garden fence. I was like crashing my car. I was like, I was a demon, a hostage, literally in my own head. I had no idea. I didn't even know what was going on. And now I'm so grateful it's talked about a lot more. But I couldn't get help on the NHS or anything. And it was just a minefield to navigate. And but really, it is just not having the tools to know how to deal with universal experiences we all go through. It was, yeah.
What brutal. When you started to try and get, what was the moment you was like, I need help? Or did someone say you need help? And how was the process? Because when you start to put your foot in the water, there's an admission of something, isn't there? But it's like, can you find the right help? And how does that start helping? What I mean by that is, I knew something was wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was, because I could tell how I was reacting to certain things in life more than anyone else. And I'd start to watch people thinking, I would have reacted different to that, and started to ask questions. And I remember seeing a therapist in Harley Street, bless him, this Australian guy. And I went in there one day and I just said to him, you know, because I modelled for a living and I was celebrated for the way I looked and the outside and stuff like that. And I was honestly, I had so much self-hate and shame at one point. I went to see this guy because when everyone said to me, oh, you look amazing, come on, I would get this anger inside, like, are you taking the mickey? And it's sad because I was probably 25 at the time. And I remember saying this to him and he laughed at me and he said, are you serious? And I was like, well, yeah, I've just paid like £100 to come and see you. Of course I am. And if I remember rightly, he gave me an elastic band on my wrist that I had to flick when I had negative thoughts about myself. And that was it. So it didn't really help.
Yeah.
So I'd try someone else, and I did yoga, then I did different courses and whatnot, but nothing touched the spot. And it wasn't until I met the right people that could explain to me, that had the same experiences as me, that I felt like I could breathe and be alive. And then I realized, actually, there's a solution to nearly everything if you're willing to take that road.
Yeah, you definitely, you have to, I went through so many processes. I didn't even know what was wrong with me. And then I was in denial. Then I was angry. Then I was like, I really need help, but I don't really want help, because actually this is, you become so in it that it's actually, it's like your friend as well.
Yeah.
Even though you know it's killing you. And then...
That's what people don't know. It's something like that takes away pain temporarily.
Yeah.
So it's a solution to a problem. And then someone's trying to take away your solution without offering something else.
Yeah. And you think you're like invincible. I was like, oh, well, you know, I'm kind of okay-ish. And yeah, I managed to, at the time I was put into a treatment center just for 6 weeks, but it was like a drug and alcohol treatment center. So they'd had no really idea of eating disorders.
Yeah.
And so I would sit next to my friend Isabel, who was there for alcohol. And I'd be, Isabel, can you have half my baked potato? No one's looking. She'd be like, yeah, sure. I was like, it's not really helping me, is it? But yeah. Like, but at the time, looking back, I was like, oh my God, I was just getting sicker in that place.
Rallied everybody around. Dismantle your plate.
No, yeah. But I learned a lot about, you know, I got into some group therapy and I started to talk because I just was like a mute. But I came out of that and I was like slightly better, went to university because, you know, my traits are that I'm very determined and
yeah.
But we're going to get there. And, you know,
so where did you go to study?
Where?
No, what?
Well, I did journalism and did a master's in broadcasting down in Cornwall. And I became a surfer and beach bum and I loved it. And
oh, amazing.
I loved being in this, in nature, and I found my tribe there in a way. Like, I feel like I was so stuck in, I'm not that academic. I'm, I guess that word creative, but that's kind of how I am. A bit of a dreamer. I love, like, you know, that kind of world. And I immersed myself in an art college, and people there were like, they had weird families, messed up families, backgrounds. You could have pink hair if you wanted. And I was like, well, this is refreshing. Like, I didn't feel so odd,
yeah. You
know? It's kind of cool. And so I loved it there, and that helped me. And I loved doing the course. And
so was it a happy period?
Yeah, it was a happy period. I mean, I still do remember one day going up and down Fynemouth High Street looking for the lowest calorie can of soup and then living on boiled sweets from WH Smith's over the road. So there were definitely not times that were, but then, yeah, I made it. I was determined to work for the BBC. So when everyone else was going on their work placements and going to the local newspaper, I was like, nah, I'm going to work for the BBC and Jeremy Vine. I luckily slept up 3 times to get that job, and I managed to get that job, and that set my career. But I'm so grateful because, yeah, I ended up spending almost 20 years there. But London was another place of super loneliness. It was probably a really lonely chapter in my life, a long chapter.
Do you think that helped you excel though when you was at work? Because when there's something lacking over here, I did that. I was obsessed with working and being the best and really, you know, this is my chance to shine. And it actually helped me be more successful in a weird way.
Yeah, definitely. And I was in a newsroom. I was in the national newsroom, and it was like, you know, breaking news. It was like high pressure and intensity, and I loved the adrenaline, but it was mainly the stories. That's why stories has always been part of my life. And I could champion the voices that didn't normally get heard, and I felt like I did a good day's job. But you know, I've interviewed some really well-known people, but I always say it was never those people that really made my heart sing. I mean, they're lovely people. Some of them lovely people, most of them lovely people, but it was always the people who trusted me to share their story who didn't have a voice that made me feel like, yeah, you've done a good day job being a journalist. And I guess being a journalist was always, you know, I was a bit like you. I was asked why is this happening? Why is that happening? I was like, oh, I could have never taken no for an answer. And I was like, well, there's another way of looking at it. Well, what's the truth behind this? I'm so curious, innately curious. And so yeah, I loved it. It's a great job of being a journalist, and it was a privilege to work there, and I loved it. But it was also a really difficult time because I had to take like 8 months off work, and I was so glad that my editor, he'd known something was going wrong for a while. I just wasn't me, whatever me was then. And he said, let's go for a coffee. And I was like, okay. I was like, let's go and sit outside. It's a nice day. I was like, okay. He said, Laura, put his arm around me. What's wrong? I was like, I'm fine. He was like, you're not. What's wrong? And then I just couldn't stop crying. And I was like, because I was terrified of losing my job. Yeah. I'd worked so hard to get that job. And he was, so I just said, this is what's happening. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm just like, not doing very well with my food and my head and all sorts. And he said, I get it, Laura. Like, and his mum had suffered from severe depression. He kind of knew the page I was on, yeah, and he had a story and he shared it. And he said, you go and do what you need to do and I'll keep your job open for you. And I was like, what?
What a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Simon, he's there. He's out there.
Takes one good person, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Because there were other editors in there who could have been emotionally constipated, what I call them, wouldn't have understood, but he had his own experience. And,
well, you can be an inconvenience to people and they can't take it instead of offering you a hand.
Yeah. Yeah. He's incredible. He's still a good friend of. And his lovely wife. But then it was, you know, I went, I was like, how am I going to get the help? I wasn't getting the help on the NHS. I was deemed not sick enough.
Which is crazy.
Yeah, and at the time it tells you the message that you need to get sicker. And I do. I remember leaving a hospital in North London. I was like, oh, you don't think I'm ill enough? Oh, I better get iller. But at the time you think that, but really the reality is that there's only so many beds and access and they have to just, you know, and I'm so grateful I didn't go into that system because I'm not entirely sure it's always the best. But I remember my therapist at the time, he sent me a book and it arrived in the post and I thought, oh my God, if I read another self-help book, I just can't scream, like, just go away. But there was something on this... I was desperate and I was in state nicotine sitting on my bed and I just thought, oh, what have you got to lose? So I opened the first few pages and in the first few pages, that was it. I was like, oh my God, this person really does speak my language.
Can I ask who's this person?
Huh?
Can I ask what book it was?
The 8 Tools to Recovery. I think it's not a very catchy title, but it was written by Carolyn Costin, who I messaged the other day. But she was the founder of this place in America. And she wrote this book from her own experience because in the 80s she had anorexia and she there was nowhere for her to go. And so she decided, well, when she recovered herself. I mean, immense, she recovered herself. But she said, I'm just going to create a place. I'm going to buy a house in a normal cul-de-sac. It's going to be not clinical at all. It's just going to have 4 bedrooms and it's going to be a place where you can heal. And it started like that. And she's a very spiritual person. She's got lots of crystals and she's amazing. But she, and in the time in the 80s, it was quite controversial because like scientists were like, what? And she, because her thing was, I'm going to fill it with some people, some members of staff who are going to be recovered themselves,
yeah,
which was quite controversial. But she did, and she created this place, and so when I read the first few pages, I was like, oh my God, this woman really gets it, because she's been through it, she's recovered, but it was the first time I was like, God, you can get better, there is another way. And but to go there, so we contacted her, but to go there, it was just ridiculous amounts of money, and just didn't have it. But with some incredible fundraising, and the generosity of a complete stranger, I was able to go for 6 weeks and that turned into like 8 months, which cost my mum her house. And it was the most, it was just so difficult to be stripped of everything, literally everything when you leave. I mean, you've been into rehab.
Yeah.
It's like, it's brutal. It's brutal. Yeah. And they tested my demon and my hostage and everything in my head, the tricks of the trade that my eating disorder would try and get away with. It was like, there's nowhere to run. It was horrible, but it was also beautiful. And I, I definitely, they saved my life there and gave me the tools to continue to save mine.
Did you have any days in there where you thought, I can't do this, or?
Oh yeah, I was almost kicked out. Because they said, I think they said your eating disorder's a motherfucker. I was like, yeah, feels like that at times. Yeah, it was pretty difficult.
Was there a turning point there? Because I remember when I was in rehab, I went first time to get treated. The second time I went was actually 5 years sober because I went for trauma therapy in Arizona and did another deep dive. But the first time I was there, it's such a... I remember one day, I remember fighting a lot, as in just thinking, what? I don't understand. How is this going to help me talking in a group of other people that have some of more problems than I do? Can't see it. And I guess it's when you saw the analogy of the surfboard. When I switched on to, and when I made a decision that I want to get better, my hearing completely changed. Mm. From hearing everything that I didn't want to hear, or all the things that I didn't understand or didn't align with me, to hearing everything I needed to hear from each person. It was the weirdest thing.
That's the thing, you have to want to get better.
Yeah.
So I could have been anywhere and I could have been there even maybe 6 months before and not have been willing to engage. So you can have the best, I don't know if you say the best treatment. What it was for me is like, I tried everything, but until someone speaks your language and shows you, literally shows you, there is another way to live, you can't believe it. Mm. I didn't believe it. And so I didn't need someone to go, there, Laura. Yeah, I knew why I was like this from my past and background. I was like, I don't need someone to tell me that. I just need to know a different way. And I also need someone to be super strict with me. And I for me, I had to go inpatient, because just going for a day patient or going to have an hour's therapy, I'd just go home and continue what I was doing. I needed that. And I can't say it, you know, I came out. I mean, that was really just the foundation. My life is recovery. Yeah. Just like, it's a continuous journey of like mainly my emotions now. But I've learned so much since then. That was in 2012. And
did you hear, I've just come to mind, did you ever hear about the, I guess it's a poem about the addict in a hole?
No.
I'm going to really mess this up.
Give it a shot.
There's an addict, he falls in this hole, he's stuck, can't get out of this hole, doing the same repetition of everything and the same mindset, just stuck in this hole. And a policeman walks along, sees this guy in the hole and says, what are you doing in the hole? He goes, oh, I'm here, I'm stuck, I can't get out, I'm just in this addiction. And he hit the policeman, this is something, well, if you don't behave, I'll arrest you, or whatever, and walks off. Then a therapist walks past and sees a guy in a hole, and he shouts down, what are you doing in the hole? He says, I'm in addiction and stuff. And the guy says, well, why don't you talk to me for an hour? He talks to him for an hour, throws him a bill, and says, I'll be back in 7 days. And then there's a guy from the church comes along and says, what's the matter, my child? And he says, oh, I'm stuck in this hole. Sends a prayer down to him, says, you'll be okay. And he's still stuck in a hole. Then an addict walks past, falls into the hole with a guy. And the guy's like, what are you doing? He said, we're now both stuck in a hole. And he said, I've been here before, I know the way out. And it's kind of like what you said when you hear someone else's story.
Yeah, it totally. I think stories have saved my life, for sure. And they continue to save my life. But because if you don't, you know, that tagline, you're not alone. You feel alone if you don't hear a story.
It's like truth really resonates with people. And if you speak from the heart hears it before the brain does, I think, because you feel it. And that's more powerful than hearing something, I believe, for your mind, because your mind can sort of like dismantle it and say, oh, well, I can find an exit plan here. But your heart really doesn't. If it feels something, it feels something.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, I was chatting to you, and like I was just thinking about Michael, and I talked about this maybe 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't even get the words out. And here I've sat here and been able to talk about it. And it's strange, isn't it? Because sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm in this setting, or but I often think about how my feelings, my emotions, or my can be different on a different day.
Yeah.
And I just think you have to go with what you are in that moment.
100%. there's no fixed thing. It's like if you're a good actor on the stage, you'll bring something different every day.
You did acting, didn't you?
I wouldn't call it that.
You did. You took a year out. You took a year out and just acting.
No, I did. I did. I studied Meisner technique in London with an incredible teacher called Tom Ratcliffe, who's a Buddhist monk. Oh, and he was sober at the time, you won't mind me saying. I've said it on here before. That was round the corner from here. And after I'd come out of treatment, I was totally and utterly, I won't say I was broken, but I was raw. Mm. I got down to the absolute depths of self. And I really had no ego and pride or anything at that time. It was just a raw shell. And a friend of mine had been seeing Tom round the corner for acting. He said, look, why don't you come and do this? And I said, I can't be around fashion. I can't be around anything in that thing. He said, just come and see him. He's really good. And I went to see Tom, and he just understood. He knew. He could see me, basically. And he's like, come and try this. It's actually really cool. And what I learned from that with him and that specific technique was to be able to deal with my emotions, express them, be in them, whether it was rage, love, sadness, whatever it was, and still talk through dialogue. So it taught me along with my recovery how to be in my body and be absolute, like at the extent of any emotion, because you have to go full range of emotions there naturally and speak a different narrative. Very clever. It's a really clever thing. So I did 3 years of him, and then I did, prior to that, in LA. I lived in LA 2000 to roughly 2003. And I went to a Meisner technique course there with a lady called Janet Alhanty, and that started to break me down. You do a repeating exercise, and it just breaks through everything, breaks through your internal dialogue. And I had lots of dark moments on the stage, and she used to say to me, you're going through stuff, kid, aren't you? And we used to walk down. She was big lady, tiny, like 4 foot something, just at boiled sweets all the time. So I used to walk down there eating boiled sweets over to the car park. And but she, I think that was the start of things for me.
Interesting.
Through that process.
Because actors are, you know, they're often deemed as, you know, more creative, troubled people, and they're allowed to escape on that stage. And...
Yeah. I think there's definitely something in there.
Yeah.
You can be.
But that's probably a very sweeping generalization.
It is, and it depends how you're trained as well, because a lot of people, I think, if they do method's interesting. I did that for 2 years as well. That's you have to be careful, I think, with that, because you can change your whole thought process.
Oh, you have to get so into immersive, like Joaquin Phoenix.
As long as you're, yeah, exactly. And I did a few things, so I was like, you know, wow. And so I think you have to have some sort of stability. But I think any creativity is, for me, only from my understanding, is not the 9 to 5, go to work, read the paper, do the thing, eat this food, go to that restaurant. It's different. And it's deemed as weird, odd, or whatever. But when you go in there, you realize that you're outside of the pattern, the norm, the system. And actually, life's rich.
Mm.
There are different opinions and views. It's actually pretty incredible.
The more difference is the better, I think. And we also think, you know, we all actually think we're more different, but in so many ways we're so alike.
Yeah.
I always think humans fundamentally we're all just looking for the same things. We want to be loved, feel seen, you want to belong. They're the things that money will never be able to fill your soul with. But but really that's what we're all just trying to do our best to survive in this world.
Yeah.
That can at times be tough, but as I was writing this morning, I fundamentally think there's more goodness in this world than there are bad.
Which is a good view to have,
and so much
sometimes difficult to have.
It is, but I've always been. I wrote this morning. It was my newsletter I write, but it's about the currency of human kindness and how rich I feel from that, and how I've been gifted it, especially in the last few months, and by people that I know, family, but also strangers, and that are not strangers now, but I do think there are some really good people. I was even on the train coming up here, and there was an older lady, and she thought she was getting off at London Bridge. So she got up. And then about 5 minutes later, the guy said, oh, you do know, actually, it's like 20 minutes more. It's the next station. She said, oh, it's okay. And he said, no, come take my seat. And she said, are you sure? And he said, yeah. You sit back down. She said, oh, well, thank you. I wouldn't have got up if I'd have known that it was going to be 20 minutes. But I just smiled in myself to myself to hearing this conversation that there are good people out there that do things like without expecting anything in return.
And they're warming.
Loved it. It made my day. Yeah. Just hearing the conversation.
So after the 8 months of pulling yourself apart and putting yourself back together again, you went back to work?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And how was that? Because that's, for people who don't know, when you do all the work on yourself in those periods of time, I think life looks and sounds different. Mm. I don't know what it was like for you to go back to work.
It was horrible. It was because I went to California for treatment, and I really didn't want to leave. I'd, you know, found like my safety bubble. It was like being in a womb there. Mm. And but obviously I had to come back, and coming back to London, I was like, God, right. And I remember walking down into the newsroom, these big spiral staircases, looking around, all these people running around with computer screens and TV screens, thinking, oh, nothing's really changed. Yeah, I am so different. Mm. And I was terrified. I was like, I hid behind the computers for a while. My editor was like, you can just do a bit of, you know, emailing. And I was like, okay, yeah, great. Yeah. And then I'd go to the tea bar and be like, hi, Laura. And there would either be someone who was oblivious to the fact that I'd gone away, because lots of people would go and like, it was so busy, no one really noticed. Or, you've been on holiday? Yeah, yeah. Or they didn't know what to say, because they did know, but they were like, okay, yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh man, this is really lonely. And
it's a really weird thing. People act like someone's died in family.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to talk about
it. Yeah, yeah. And But after me being there after like 2 or 3 weeks, I was like, this is pretty boring behind the computer. I want to do more. And so I pitched to do something. In fact, it was, yeah, I don't remember what it was. And my editor was like, are you sure you can do that? I was like, yeah, just give me a shot. I'll do it. I did it, pulled it off. And after that, my career just grew again. And I got the confidence to put myself out there. And I really thrived again, and it made me think, you know, with someone who can understand or be give you a shot, you don't have to be deemed as fragile or vulnerable. And there have been times when I did have a panic attack one day when I at work, and I was meant to be sent to go and cover a story, and I was like, I can't do that. But I also thought, if I don't do it, they'll never ask me to do anything again. But they did, and sent someone else. And I think really the turning point of me being able to sort of speak about it, because I had never even been here and chatting to you about this. It was like an elephant in the room for like most of my life. And was when an editor had been away in the States, and he'd suffered from depression, and he had gone to study how American organizations tackled mental health in the workplace. And this was like, you know, about eight years ago, maybe 4 or 5. Yeah, maybe, no, but probably 8 years ago. And he came back, and after sabbatical, and he came into the BBC, and he said, look, we really need to think about how we approach mental health in this place, and launched a campaign and asked me to be part of it as one of 5 people to share their stories. And I thought,
how was that shared, in like a newsletter? Or
no, it was around the, you know, the Cambridge, they launched that Heads Together campaign, and we thought we'd do something similar called Open Up, and they supported it, I believe. And it was about going on camera and sharing your story on video, which would be a video that would go across the internet to the entire BBC, which is pretty big.
Very brave as well.
And I was like, I can't do that. And then I thought, oh, geez, Laura, everyone knows anyway. You might as well tell your story instead of letting everyone else make their own narrative up. and also the encouragement of others. We had a cameraman who'd had PTSD in Afghanistan. We had a BBC 3 reporter who you probably would never know had terrible OCD. The fact that he thought he couldn't even leave his house and get on the tube because he thought he was going to murder someone. Not the kind of hand-washing OCD, but that kind of OCD. Someone who had really bad postnatal depression. And I thought, gosh, if these people, and we all talk together, and thought, I can do this if they can. And so I did. And I remember the day when it went out, the video went on the internet, and I was like, oh God, oh, waiting. And then I think by lunchtime, I'd had my inbox was like constantly coming through of emails going, thanks for sharing that. I'm going through the same thing. I don't know who to talk to. And I was like, oh my God. And these were people, senior people as well. I had one. And you would never have known them, Paul. These are people you meet. You go in the canteen or the tea bar and you have no idea that these people are struggling with these things. It was a very cathartic exercise for me because I felt, oh, finally I can be me, not, a pretend me. But also I was just so profoundly grateful for these people who had shared their vulnerability with me, and that if anything I had shared, such a cliche, if anything I had shared might help someone else, but I hope it did. And the campaign actually still launches today. I think there's a poster of me above the, someone sent me a picture of the campaign above the Five Live printer the other day. I said, Laura, it's still running. And I was like,
that's actually incredible. It says a lot.
It was a great campaign. And the guy who did it, he's incredible. But so I was so glad to be part of that. And it was really then that I started to think about flipping the narrative of mental health in the workplace and everything.
Is that where the title come from, the podcast?
The podcast,
which is great, by the way.
Thank you. It's a passion project. It was a passion project that only started a year ago, and I did it because I went through another difficult chapter in my life 3 years ago when I spoke with my boyfriend of a long time, partner of a long time, and I decided to leave the BBC because I was...
Might as well do two big things at once.
Well, actually, no. That was the first thing. Yeah. And then I didn't have anywhere to live. So I was living out of a bag. And then at the same time, in the space of three weeks, I split up with him, didn't have anywhere to live. And then the BBC were like, oh, Laura, you're going to have to come back into London. I can't make this decision. I'm literally heartbroken. I don't know what I'm doing, where I'm living. And I thought, you're just going to have to just leave and make your way somehow. But the BBC was an identity for me. I didn't know what else I was good at. What I could do without the BBC. But I went on a discovery of myself and I made the decision to leave. And I would find my way, and I spent hours walking in the countryside and on the beach listening to Eckhart Tolle, if you've ever...
I listened to Eckhart Tolle for a year and a half. Yeah. I couldn't sleep every night. And I'll tell you how long ago it was. I had a CD disc.
Yeah.
And I listened to it. It was when I was living in LA. And I just had to listen to him every night.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one. He became my best friend that he doesn't even know he's my best friend. Yeah. but he really taught me how to live in the present moment.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time listening to podcasts, which I'd never done before. And I've always written in journals. I'm a profound writer in journal, and it's always been a real place that I can make sense of my thoughts when I can't anywhere else. And I just sat there one day and thought, I've produced podcasts, I've shared other people's stories, but I want to share the stories I want to share now. I can. And I thought, I don't. But then I procrastinated on it for ages because I thought, well, there's so many podcasts out there. Who needs another bloody podcast? I'll be the last person to say that. And then I thought, but this is not about anybody else. You're just doing it for yourself. I wanted to find the people that could maybe help me in my heartbreak, in my grief, or people who've been through it and could. I almost thought this is going to be my place of therapy. So I used my journal entries as kind of material to bring into the podcast. And I guess I called it Flip It. One, because flipping me from being behind the camera onto the camera, I guess, but mainly because I had someone say when I was going through that chapter, I would drive in the car and there'd be tears coming down my face, and I know it sounds very dramatic, but I would also be laughing and smiling because I was now living in the most beautiful countryside, and I would be driving looking at these fields and seeing the sheep. Honestly, I know it sounds terrible.
It sounds ridiculous. The movie.
Yeah. No. But I still live there now, but I was like, I was so grateful. And so I've always been a glass half full person. I'm glad I'm programmed like that. But I've always found positive in a negative. There is always a different way of looking at it. Even in my darkest times, I have struggled, but I have found that, and generally in people and hearing other people's stories. And so I always believed that you could flip it if you could just change your narrative, which is why I'm so passionate about narrative transformation and stories. So I thought, all right, let's call it flip it, flipping a negative into a positive and flipping me from being around the camera. And I just thought, I'll go and find people who don't normally get a platform, who have been through universal experiences, and see what happens. And it has become the richest chapter of my life, honestly, Phil. Yeah. It's richest in the people I have met who have shared their stories with me, who have helped me to think differently about the world. It's just reinforced my belief that this world is full of kindness. And incredible humans, everyday heroes that we meet all day, every day, yet we actually don't really meet them or listen to them. We meet them in our shops, in the Londis, in the post office, whatever. And we say the same things, or, hi, how are you? Good weekend. Yeah. Kids good. Yeah. Yeah. And you move on. But actually, there's so much going on behind these people. Mm. If we only listened or paid attention, we'd learn so much about ourselves and others, and the fact that we're all really interconnected.
This is the key, though, isn't it? It's being interdependent and interconnected. But I don't think it helps what's in the media and the news, and also things you read all the time. Like, I'm generalizing, because it can keep you distant from people instead of connected. And it takes something to slow down enough to see. And then once I think you start seeing it and hearing things, it's like this food, like a nutrition.
Yeah, it is.
I had a moment today on the train, because you said it, and there was a guy sitting there, and he was all dressed in black. He had a hoodie on, and he had a mobile phone with no earphones in, and disturbed everyone. And everyone was like really annoyed.
Right.
And then I was actually listening to another one of your podcasts. And then also I got a whack on the back of the head. I was like, what was that? I turned around, I looked at this guy. He was quite menacing looking. I looked at him, and he'd clearly stood up and pushed his arm into his jacket and hit me on the head at the same time. And I looked at him straight in the eye, and he had this moment of, I'm actually really sorry. And I saw it just quickly. No one else would have seen it. I saw it. I was like, it's okay, mate. Thank you. Mm. And he was like, yeah, just walked off. But yeah, I saw it in him.
Yeah.
And I was like, he was really... didn't mean it. You know, it takes you to be present to see that, doesn't it?
Yeah, you saw that in him, yeah. Because I could have gone another way. You could have been like, oh, yeah.
I could have run. Then, But no, it could have turned. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I laughed the other day because I got diagnosed with dyslexia at 40, and you were talking about numbers.
Oh, my God. Numbers are my, yeah.
And then you found out what it's called, right?
Dyscalculia, yeah. It was actually when I was having... I was interviewing someone about dyslexia, and the way they talked about it, I said to them, do you know how you talk about dyslexia is how I feel about numbers. But it's been a real thing in my family of like, yeah, Laura, she's not very good with numbers, she's not very good with finances. And I'm not saying it's not entirely not true, but I panic. I can't, like, words to me, I can magic them all together, and I think about words all day every day. It's like, but numbers is fear. And so, yeah. And so when I found this thing called dyscalculia, I looked up, I was like, oh my God, that is me. That is me. And so, yeah, I mean, labels, whatever it is, it's just, it helps you to understand a little bit about maybe that's why you think that way. And
I just found it amusing because I'm the same with words.
Yeah.
When I open a page.
Are you good with numbers?
Brilliant.
Oh, brilliant. We can
numbers
swap.
And directions. Like, drop me anywhere with a parachute and I'll find my way home. But I see, when I see, like, with my cards, I see the white lines down between the words is the first thing, lines down. And I see it, I jump. So I had to practice. If I read an American accent, I can read better than I can with a British accent. I don't know why. So when I read my kids, I change my accents to joke around. But no, it's like it's a weird superpower. I always thought it was a bad thing. But actually you see things, I see things better in color, shapes. Mm. So I can tell you where I'm facing, like, and as in, if you put me in this city, I can tell you I'm east, west, north.
Wow, that's
it's really weird. My wife's completely opposite. She's amazing. She's great with words like you and stuff, but she's not good with numbers and places. She'll walk out and think, did we come from there? Like, it's a nice superpower. So we have a nice, like,
yeah, that's a great balance.
Change in it, yeah.
I mean, we can't all be good at everything, let's be honest.
No. We're running out of time, unfortunately, but I'd love to. Thanks for being so open. I really think it's important for people to hear, because you can be judged on the outside for being successful, put together and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And no one knows the inside story. And I think it's really brave to share it. If someone's listening to this particular one today, what would you say if they had, for example, an eating disorder, they're struggling with food, it's a big deal inside, no one knows on the outside. What would you suggest that they do for a first move?
It's so individual and so different for everybody. There is no one size fits all. You know inside that something's not quite right. Listen to that and don't ignore it, because you'll kid yourself that you can get better on your own,
yeah,
and that it won't get worse, because it can so rapidly get worse so quickly. And also I would say that if you think you can't live another way, you bloody well can. And I can tell you, life is so much better. It's like a parent telling a child to do something, they're never going to listen to you. That's how it was. But if you can hold on to a glimmer, if you know inside yourself that you don't, I used to say there's that Robbie Williams line in his song Feel. And it reminded me, because it was exactly how I felt. I didn't want to die, but I wasn't keen on living either. And I felt like that so many times. Mm. But because I knew I didn't want to die, that kept me going. And so I would say to someone, find stories, find people who are willing to speak to you, who have been there before you. They'll be your best therapy, because no therapy, counselor, whatever, will ever speak your language. You need to find the people who speak your language and can show you and tell you that there is another way.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scolfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up, and you can get in touch with us, because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scolfort.